from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We have seen Russia's playbook in Transnistria, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, and Crimea. So the question is not what Russia will try to do in eastern Ukraine. The question is what we, the international community, will seek to do to prevent yet another frozen conflict in Europe manufactured by Russia.
That was the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power, at a meeting of the Security Council called by the U.S., accusing Russia of stoking hostilities in eastern Ukraine after NATO and the OSCE claimed that Russian military equipment was sent into the east to benefit separatists in the Donbass region. Russia's deputy permanent representative answered her charges at the end of the council session.
Thank you, Mr. President. First, I would call upon colleagues of the Security Council to not go beyond council meetings, turning them to farces. We carefully listened to the briefings of the ASG on political issues, Mr. Torgerberg Fransson. We thank him for the information. We also thank the chief monitor of the OSCE SMM, Mr. Apakan, as well as the representative of the chairperson office of the OSCE, Madam Taliavini. We were interested to see the evaluations of those who are directly working on the ground and every day make efforts to settle the situation in the east, southeast of the Ukraine. However, we think that bringing international players to Security Council meetings, those who are acting under the OSCE, is not totally appropriate, not to speak of the fact that this distracts them from their direct obligations and politicizes practical activities. The goal of their invitation was actually this, is confirmed by what we heard in statements today by a number of council members who used our platform and OSCE representatives, not for constructively seeking a solution to an internal Ukrainian crisis, but for yet another foray into propaganda with new flourishes. Mr. President, the situation in Donetsk and Lugansk remains tense, of course. The ceasefire regime is not fully being complied with. The withdrawal of heavy weaponry and equipment hasn't begun. On the contrary, over the past period, the ceasefire is actually turning into a concentration of Ukrainian forces on all lines of the front. And indeed, this concentration of Ukrainian forces is going on very near the cities of Donbas, where the rebels are forced to protect. As a result, there are clashes between the parties and civilians killed every day, in particular in territories controlled by the Ukrainian armed forces in Nadiev and Peska. There are systematic shellings near the airport of Donetsk, that is the residential areas of the city, on 6 November. From this region, from the northwest, a mine was launched, and this is confirmed by OSCE monitors, and it fell to a soccer field of a school there, where 2 children were killed and 3 wounded. The shelling with cluster munitions from the very same position in October led to deaths amongst staff of the ICRC. Now, in the Russian language, there's only one truth. It doesn't occur in the plural form. However, lies do. And given this ignoring of the truth, it's actually logical that rebels would seek to strengthen their positions in areas which are constantly under attack from armed forces. It would seem that there's such a fear of rebels in Kiev that to justify their misfortunes and the massive sending to the front of people and equipment, we're hearing declarations about Russians sending weapons and members of the regular army. Now, we're also hearing broad declarations from NATO regarding the sending of convoys and Russian fighters from Russia, but that isn't actually reflecting the situation on the ground. These are empty statements and the usual propagandistic falsifications, in particular in the current conditions. The Russian-Ukrainian border is subject of particular careful attention and monitoring, and is carefully easily monitored from space, amongst other things. Unfortunately, we have to recognize that we're discouraged by the full lack of a response from the OSCE mission, the movement and strengthening of positions of the Ukrainian armed forces and other subunits who have their own fathers, or rather daddies, as a colleague stated, in this room. It's not clear to whom they are accountable, but on 9 November in Karlova, heavy artillery and tanks entered. 8 November in Lugansk, there was a grad hurricane system, Scud system, all of these entered in the Krasnoitalivka in Lugansk. Again, a group of 500 Ukrainian armed forces entered on 7 November from the eastern area of Garlovka. 32 tanks entered in Artyomsk, 13 tanks, 15 auto anti-aircraft Shilkas, 17 tactical systems, Tochka-U, 6 reactive systems of volley fire, again Grad systems. In 6 November, in the area of Donetsk, in Usnavataya, a tank convoy entered. Why are these things being covered up or not talked about? It has to be clear that there's a lack of information on this in the OSCE report, and thus a reverse or provocative picture of the situation has arisen, and we hope this will be rectified. Sir, we believe there's a need for full and careful compliance by sides of the conflict of the Minsk agreement, to the Minsk agreement. Critical issues is stating a genuine ceasefire, which would be responsibly complied with by both sides. But of equal importance in the agreement are those items regarding decentralization of power, inclusive dialogue, measures for improving the humanitarian and economic situation in Donbas. But here the Ukrainian authorities are doing nothing. We're also concerned about Mr. Poroshenko's decision to annul the law on a special status for certain regions of Lugansk and Donetsk. This was the linchpin of the Minsk agreements, which essentially now have been totally annulled. The law wasn't ideal, and it had a legitimate limitation. That is, the former High Rada wasn't able to delimitate the areas which would have a special status. And the date of elections, 7 December, wasn't agreed upon with representatives from Donetsk and Luhansk, and was a violation of the Constitution of Ukraine. However, the law could have become a foundation for further talks between Kiev and the rebels. Kiev also didn't implement an important provision of the Minsk agreement. That was the amnesty law for participants to events that did not enter into force. The representative of the High Rada is actually asking for annulment of this law. Guarantees for the personal security of participants to the consultations weren't provided either. Regarding the humanitarian aspect of the agreements, instead of measures to rebuild Donbas, the Ukrainian government has decided on a new order for financing for the budgets and social and pension payments. All of these things were actually just canceled. So what kind of trust could the average person have in the Kiev government when they're daily being bombed and not even allowed to exist? And here we reject any allegations against Russia regarding the sending of humanitarian convoys with food, medications, and building materials from Donetsk and Lugansk. These are just strange given the situation. When convoys are sent, the contents are always reported upon fully and completely. And unfortunately, the people in these regions depend on the convoys, and the people in these regions don't seem to be of concern for the government at all. Now, regarding 2 November's elections in Donetsk and Lugansk, a number of delegations have expressed strange emotions about these elections as if they weren't democratic. But I'd like to underscore the following. The Russian Federation respects the demonstration of will of the people of the East, Southeast. The elections were organized, and there was a high turnout. And what's most important is that the representatives received a mandate for resolving practical tasks in reinstating regular life in those areas. There's no threat to the Minsk agreements contained in this process. And moreover, there are unique opportunity for instating sustainable dialogue between the central Ukrainian authorities and representatives of Donbas, so as to seek comprehensive political solutions and dealing with the backlog of disagreements. There's no alternative to inclusive dialogue on a respectable and reciprocal basis. This was spoke about in spring. It's time for Kiev to uphold its obligations under Geneva, all the more so that there are frameworks for these negotiations. Thank you.
Wednesday morning, NATO claimed that it observed columns of Russian tanks, artillery, and combat troops entering Ukraine over the prior 2 days. The Russian Defense Ministry denied NATO's allegations. On Wednesday, spokesperson Major General Igor Konashenkov said that the rumors of alleged Russian military presence in Ukraine are, quote, completely untrue and not backed by any facts. As NATO ends its 13-year-long mission in Afghanistan, the country is now a narco state producing 90% of the world's heroin. RT's Gayan Chichikayan reports.
Record high drug production has turned Afghanistan into a narco-criminal state. The U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction says it's likely to get worse after 2014, when the bulk of coalition troops leave the country.
All of the fragile gains we have made over the last 12 years on women's issues, health, education, rule of law and governance, are now, more than ever, in jeopardy of being wiped out by the narcotics trade.
The Inspector General has criticized U.S. leaders for not making counter-narcotics their top priority in Afghanistan. American and NATO officials hardly ever mention the rampant drug production in their speeches, instead presenting a rosier picture.
More Afghans have hope for their future, and so much of that is because of you.
Compared to the situation in 2001-2002, Afghanistan and the world is safer because of what we have done in Afghanistan, our presence there.
Since the U.S. toppled the Taliban in 2002, opium production has tripled. The Taliban, which prior to the U.S. invasion had fought drugs, now derive a third of their income from opium sales, according to a U.N. Security Council report. The country accounts for 90% of the world's heroin market, making it a global security threat. Opium puppies in Afghanistan now cover a territory 12 times the size of Washington, D.C.
By every conceivable metric, we've failed. Production and cultivation are up, interdiction and eradication are down, financial support to the insurgency is up, and addiction and abuse are at unprecedented levels in Afghanistan.
The Inspector General report says the $7 billion that the U.S. spent to fight drug production in Afghanistan since 2002 have had no effect. But the U.S. has never set the goal of completely eradicating Afghanistan's opium poppy fields.
The report on the dramatic increase in Afghanistan's drug production flies in the face of statements about how the war in Afghanistan has made the world safer. Not only does the drug money foster corruption and insurgency in Afghanistan, it also funds international criminal networks. Not to mention, of course, the thousands of people across the world who die from heroin addiction every year. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chekan, RT.
Leaders of the 21 members of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group concluded their meeting in Beijing after passing a roadmap to closer economic integration, including a free trade area in the region. China's President Xi Jinping met the press at the APEC conference Tuesday.
We have exchanged views deeply on the matters of regional economic integration as well as cooperation. We have reached a wide consensus in this matter. We have passed the Beijing Agenda, building an integrated, innovative, and interconnected Asia-Pacific, the joint declaration by the APEC leaders.
Violence will not be tolerated.
That was Missouri Governor Jay Nixon on Tuesday, warning protesters gathered in Ferguson as they await the findings of the grand jury investigating the shooting of Michael Brown last August. The killing of Michael Brown aroused a harsh response around the country, particularly in black and brown communities that have seen one of their young men killed by police on a national average of every 28 hours. That response has been sustained at a high level for the 3 months following the Ferguson killing, and the state, county, and local authorities in and around Ferguson are not the only ones making preparations for the outcome of the grand jury. This past weekend, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a rally and march on the White House, and Ferguson was at the top of the agenda of those in attendance. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
Larry Hamm, chairman of POP, the New Jersey-based People's Organization for Progress, spoke for the entire coalition of black organizations when he called for massive demonstrations in the streets of every U.S. city on the day after. By that, he meant the day after a grand jury decides whether or not to indict the police officer that killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
I'm glad to be here to join with you today in this demonstration as we demand justice at home and abroad. And I just want to begin with the issue of police brutality in our community. And the theme that dovetails with that, which was addressed by the speaker before her, and that is the militarization that is going on in our communities. But brothers and sisters, the militarization of the black community did not begin in Ferguson. It didn't begin in 2014. Militarization began when the first slaves were taken from Africa. That's when militarization began.
That's right.
Because you cannot enslave a people without the exercise, the use of the most brutal, heinous, and horrific force that can be imagined. And this begins with the slave trade, and it continues through the enslavement of Africans in the Western Hemisphere. The state police, as we know them today, state militia, as we know them today, grew out of the slave patrols of those colonies that had enslaved Africans and enslaved indigenous people. Because remember, their enslavement began before ours. In fact, last month was Columbus Day. People run around here celebrating Columbus. That should have been a national day of mourning for black and brown people all throughout the United States of America. A national day of mourning. Because it is with the advent of Columbus in the Caribbean that we see the beginning of the slave trade in the Western Hemisphere. The first slaves he took were the indigenous, the Arawak, the Carib, the Boricua. And then when that didn't work out, they went and got the African. And we see with the rise and development of the slave trade, the use of the most brutal force imaginable, both publicly condoned and sanctioned by law and privately on the property of those slave masters. Slaves were whipped and flogged and beaten and flayed. You know what flailing is? That's when they tear your skin off of your body. That's flailing. And it, you know, I was reminded of this with the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. What happened after they shot Michael Brown? They let his body lay in the street, not for a half hour or an hour or a delay because traffic was bad and the ambulance get through. They let Michael Brown's body lay on the streets of Ferguson for 4 damn hours. Why? Why would they leave his body out there? Was it just some oversight? Some bureaucratic snafu? No. This was the technique of terror. It was meant to set a terroristic message to the black community that this is what is in store for you. But fortunately, the black youth of Ferguson were not scared, and they stood up and they raised up their voices and they raised themselves up in opposition to what is going on in Ferguson. But this is what they used to do during slave rebellions. They would behead African slaves and put their heads on pike. Read the story of Nat Turner, whose birthday just passed in October. They would draw and quarter slaves. Do you know what drawn quartering is? That's when they tie a horse on every limb of your body and whip those horses until they tear your body apart. The very Constitution of this country sanctioned, condoned, supported the enslavement of African people and the indigenous people in this country. And so institutions of force had to grow up and develop to hold people, because people are not going to be peacefully enslaved. The history of black people in this country, contrary to what we have been taught, is not a history of the acceptance of oppression. It is a history of resistance and rebellion every day that we have been here in the Western Hemisphere, brothers and sisters. There were hundreds of slave rebellions. And the slave rebellions didn't end with the Civil War. Every time black people rise up against police brutality like they rose up in Ferguson, that is a slave rebellion. That is an rebellion of the racially oppressed in this country. And I tell you today that Ferguson might be the first in a while, but it's not going to be the last, brothers and sisters. They keep killing our people like this. We're going to keep fighting back. And if they don't play by the rules, then we don't have to play by nobody's rules. In fact, all rules will be off. If they continue to kill our people, shoot them down like dogs every day of the year with impunity and receive no punishment. Amadou Diallo shot 19 times. No punishment, not even a ticket. Trayvon Martin, no penalty. No penalty. We could call names all day long. They kill us with impunity. But it's time for us to build a national response to this. You know, it's like a passion play. How many Catholics we got in here? You know the passion play, the story of Jesus, right? You know the story, right? You know what the outcome is going to be, right? You know what the stations of the cross are, right? You know where Jesus stopped and everything. What's going on right now in Ferguson is a passion play. We know what the outcome is going to be. The grand jury is not going to indict Darren Wilson for the murder of Michael Brown. They're not going to do it. They've already sent signals to you that they're not going to do it. The mayor, 4 or 5 months after Michael's death, issued an apology. What is that? That's an attempt to placate people. That's what they call it, soft counterinsurgency. Because you know the same techniques, the same counterinsurgency techniques that they use over there, they use it over here. The same counterinsurgency techniques they use in Palestine, they use it on black communities right there. Soft insurgency, they bring out the community leaders, they bring out the politicians, and they tell everybody, be calm. It's all right. We got this. Look, we're going to implement some reforms. We're going to hire more black police officers. We're going to have more black supervisors. We're going to have residency requirements. We're going to have sensitivity training. We're going to create a civilian review board. We're going to have body cameras. But all of that ain't justice. Justice is the arrest and imprisonment and conviction of Darrell Wilson, who killed Michael Brown. That's justice, brothers and sisters. Anything short of that is not justice. Anything short of that is not justice. Anything short of that are reforms to placate and diminish your righteous indignation and your righteous anger. But this is what I have to say about what's going on in Ferguson. and about what's happening with the grand jury. I say that the day after, if the grand jury decision comes on a Monday, then on a Tuesday. If it comes on a Thursday, then on a Friday. If it comes on Friday, then on Saturday. Whatever the day is that they come back without an indictment, we should fill the streets of America the very next day, brothers and sisters. Fill the streets of America. Fill the streets of America. I call on today every organization, every grassroots organization, every political party, every labor union, every church, every mosque, every fraternal organization, every sorority, every fraternity, every block club, any chess club. I don't care what your club is. You take your members into the streets the day after that grand jury verdict comes back, brothers and sisters. And it shouldn't be one day of protest. We should keep the fire lit for as long as we can. Because I don't know about you. I can't take it anymore. I can't watch my black mother's tears anymore. I can't see the grief of my people anymore. I can't stand to see one more mother without her son, one more sister without her brother, one more grandfather without his son. I can't take it no more. And it's time for us to strike back. They hit us, we hit back, brothers and sisters. We got to hit back. It can't be any of that accepting our oppression anymore or trying to say it's something other than what it is. I don't know about you, but I don't see any improvement in the condition of the masses of people here in the United States. What I see is the further immiseration of the people. I don't see any American dream, as Malcolm said. I see an American nightmare. I see families that have lost their homes to foreclosure. I see millions of people. You can't go to any one of these fast food restaurants and sit there for more than 10 minutes without somebody coming up to you and ask. They ain't even asking for money no more. They're asking for food. The people are begging in the streets, and yet the corporate class is taking home more profits than have ever been made in the history of mankind. I say it's time for a change. I say we take their corporate profits and put it in the hands of the people who are losing their homes. Put it in the hands of the students that are thousands of dollars in debt. Put it in the hands of the homeless that don't have a place to live. Put it in the hands of the PTA for all the schools that they're closing here in Washington, D.C. Put it in the hands of the families who've lost their sons and their daughters to police brutality. We need a change, brothers and sisters. We just don't need reform. We need revolution. That's what we need in America. We need revolution. And we need to get organized and build up our organizations. And don't be afraid to say we need revolution. You ain't saying nothing else that Dr. King didn't say. You going on what the corporate class told you about Dr. King. Now read what Dr. King himself said. He said we need a radical transformation of our socioeconomic system. Those are his words. He said we need a radical redistribution of power and wealth in this country. But that's not going to come about through wishing and hoping and singing and praying. That's going to come about through organizing our people and helping them to understand that we must change this situation, not just for ourselves, brothers and sisters, but for future generations. So if you don't remember anything else that I said today, remember this: the day after, the day after, the day after, the day after, the day after. Fill the streets. Fill the streets. Fill the streets. Thank you. Power to the people.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.